97.1 FM Talk. On demand audio.
Welcome in. I'm Ryan Recker filling in for Mark Reardon. Happy to be with you today. A lot going on in the news. I'll tell you, nothing derails a show like Ozzy Osbourne dying. If you haven't heard the news, I know Fox covered it there. But, you know, I remember growing up and you think about the staples of rock radio, and Black Sabbath and Ozzy Osbourne are definitely on top of the list. I never saw them in concert. I don't think I ever had a chance to see them. It's not like they toured a lot, but they were definitely on the radio. And I know back in my younger days, the good old classic rock long-haired type of day, I never really had long hair, but the long-haired days that you couldn't work on a radio station, at least on a rock station, and not play Ozzy Osbourne. So passed away, at least the family announced it happened this morning at the age of 76. It's with some sadness. Then mere words cannot convey that we have to report that our beloved Ozzy Osbourne has passed away this morning. Not exactly sure the cause of death. They haven't really said yet. Now, he did have a Parkinson's diagnosis, and he canceled part of his tour in the past because of health problems. I think the thing that is most notable with all of this is he just did a concert like a week and a half ago. It was like the Goodbye to Ozzy Osbourne concert. And they wheeled him out, and he had this giant throne that he was sitting on. And he went out there and he sang his songs. And I don't know if that was really him singing or not. It was pretty convincing. I mean, it sounded and looked like him. But I guess very well it could have been lip syncing. But still, he went out and got to say goodbye in his own way, which is, you know, I think more than a lot of us get in life. So Ozzy Osbourne, we're going to talk about throughout the course of the show. I think we're actually going to have someone on a little after 5 o'clock to talk Ozzy, so which is pretty neat. There's a lot going on, and one thing that kind of got me a little riled up, I wouldn't say riled up, but a little, I looked at it and I said, all right, you kidding me here? So you have so much business on the table, and House Republicans are like, all right, we're just going to leave for our annual August recess. It's a 5-week recess early because we're tired of people asking us about the Jeffrey Epstein stuff. So see ya, we're just going to avoid this. It's basically the president, Donald Trump, put them in a position where they have to defend not releasing the Epstein files. They don't want to have to answer for it. They also don't at the same time want to go against the president's wishes and go against him. So they're a little nervous. They're like, ah, oh, this puts us in a tough spot. Maybe we'll just go home, which is exactly what they're doing. I think what they're talking about now is coming back early to fill some appointments. Yeah, essentially they said they can call recess back. And I think they're looking at doing this in August just so they can get things rolling. So they're shifting their vacation some, or at least their time off. And that's just one of the things that are going on. The other thing, there's so much that we're going to have to talk to in the show. I do want to talk more about the whole Stephen Colbert thing. I mean, this is just going way out of control. And the other part of this, too, is the reaction to Stephen Colbert getting canceled. We'll talk about that. There's a journalist that I really respect, Matt Taibbi, and I always wonder if I say his name wrong, but he was one of the very first forerunners when it came to discovering the Twitter files. And if you remember correctly, he was uncovering what was going on behind the scenes of Twitter, the censoring that was going on. I know he's someone that testified in front of Congress. He was very reliable, and the information that he gave was accurate and true. And he got a lot of criticism for that, pointing out the biases that were there on social media platforms. And it wasn't just Twitter, but it was also Facebook and all these other major giant tech companies that were not only censoring information, but working directly with the Obama administration in order to censor people based on what they wanted the social media networks to do. And on top of that, you had the whole Russia story. And then you had the Hunter Biden laptop. All of this stuff was going on around the same time, where this false information was getting pumped from the government and true information was being censored by a request from the government who was telling these tech companies what to do. It was a very weird time. But the Hunter Biden laptop story, if you recall, they said, oh, this is Russian propaganda, while the Obama administration was pumping out Russian propaganda and finding out that it wasn't even Russian propaganda. It was just Obama propaganda against Donald Trump, which we're going to have to get to in the show, too. But Matt Taibbi was talking about some of the Obama allegations, because this all goes back to that period in time when all of this censorship, all of this, these lies were going on by the government. If we can play clip number 12, this is on Tulsi Gabbard's Obama allegations.
These new documents that were released by Tulsi Gabbard and the Director of National Intelligence make it clear that the investigation is now aimed at the Obama White House, and in particular at Barack Obama, because of decisions that were made in early December of 2016 to suppress the presidential daily briefing and go ahead and order a new intelligence community assessment that ultimately would have much more aggressive conclusions about Trump and Russia.
Yeah. So these are pretty big revelations that are going on here. And Donald Trump talked about it as well. We can play clip number 25.
Witch hunt that you should be talking about is they caught President Obama absolutely cold, Tulsi Gabbard. What they did to this country in 2016, starting in 2016, but going up all the way going up to 2020 and the election, they tried to rig the election. And they got caught, and there should be very severe consequences for that.
Okay, so he uses the term "tried to rig the election." Now, keep in mind, Donald Trump ended up winning despite that. But knowing what we know now, in retrospect, and we'll just go through this one more time. You had the Obama administration that was sending emails to these big tech companies to tell them, we don't like what this one person's saying. You need to either censor, deplatform, or delete their account, or make sure no one sees this out of the behest of the best interest of the government. Okay. A lot of times we find out that Mark Zuckerberg, even in retrospect, looked back at those days and said, we made terrible mistakes doing what the government told us to do, as opposed to some oversight on our part, which would be able to determine if their request was A, lawful, or B, necessary. At the same time, you had these big intelligence agencies coming out and saying this Hunter Biden laptop story is Russian propaganda. You can't put that out there because it is going to influence this election. And what you're doing is you're giving into foreign powers to influence this election. And these big companies agreed. You had major publications, including the New York Post, who broke this story, that got deplatformed and were not allowed to share this story. It ended up being 100% accurate. And at that same time, we get to see some of these emails thanks to Matt Taibbi. And he shows what was going on behind the scenes as we get a peek into this. Elon Musk buys Twitter. Twitter says, okay, Matt, go ahead. Let's open it up. And I want you to look at all these emails. He posts his discoveries and found really shocking things that the Obama administration and these major agencies were doing to these tech companies. And then you have other people coming back and testifying, like Facebook, Mark Zuckerberg saying, yeah, this is exactly what was happening with us too. So they were lying about these things. They were caught lying, and their intentions were, oh, you know, we just really thought it was this, but we were wrong. Now we find out that it was an intentional act when it comes to this Russian propaganda, that it was not only discredited, but then the discredit was hidden. And then it was pushed out as fact in order to purposely influence the election in 2016. And if you were to have brought this up at any other time, you'd have said it's just these crazy conspiracy theorists that are messaging these, trolling these boards, and it's all lies. And it sounds like Russia. Wow, it sounds like Russian trolls that are bringing up this information. As it was turned out, it looks like Tulsi Gabbard has direct evidence that these things go up the chain as far as the president of the United States. And there's no reason to believe it wasn't the vice president as well when it comes to Obama and Biden. And this evidence shows that it was a direct manipulation, and it was by their hands. This is a huge, huge deal. So when you have Donald Trump coming out and saying, this is like a clear-cut case of election interference, I think Donald Trump even said, perhaps this could even go as far as treason. I don't know if it goes that far. I mean, I think you'd have to be able to prove a lot more than that. But what it does show you is that the Obama administration, the Biden, even afterwards, and the people that were all involved, they were not clean in any of this. There was not a reconciliation of their wrongdoing. And there has to be at some point, particularly because you directly prosecuted the president of the United States, Donald Trump. And if you're going to go after him through these means, then guess what? You just said fair game to anyone that's ever served in the White House. That includes Obama and that includes Biden. So why would you say, oh, you know what? We're going to turn the other cheek in this instance with all the evidence that's mounting against them. And this is basically how the game's played. Once you open this box, there's no stopping it again. You know, if you want to reach me on Facebook or Twitter, it's really easy for you to do that at Ryan Recker on Twitter, Ryan Recker Radio on Facebook. We got a lot to get to on the show. And Charles Lipson's going to join us. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Chicago. He writes for The Spectator. And I want to talk to him about the plan to shut down the Department of Education, his thoughts on that coming up. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Mark Reardon, 97.1 FM Talk. Find Mark in all the usual spots like Twitter at Mark Reardon, KFTK. He's on Facebook. We got the live video going. You can see me in the closet I'm in right now. Well, I wanted to bring up Charles Lipson. He's a professor emeritus at the University of Chicago, writes for The Spectator magazine, Real Clear Politics, among other things. Charles Lipson, thank you so much for joining us here in St. Louis.
What a pleasure. What a pleasure.
So this is the headlines I read, that if we were to do anything to the Department of Education, we would be hurting all Americans. We would be hurting the children, irreparable harm. What do you think about the plan for the federal Department of Education and shutting it down?
Well, I think the key here is to make a distinction between federal assistance for education and the role of the Department of Education. The two are not the same. And in fact, what happens when you funnel all the money through Washington is that the bureaucrats take a huge cut. And I think we can do things much more efficiently, not only because we're paying for a lot of mortgages in Bethesda and Alexandria, but because the first thing bureaucrats do is put on bureaucratic regulations. And that not only means that you've got a lot of money that is, quote, going to education, that's really paying for bureaucrats to write rules, but, and I've seen this firsthand, all local schools, K-12, but also colleges and universities, have to build up a huge bureaucratic staff to answer all the paperwork that is foisted on them by the federal government. So I think cutting the Department of Education without cutting some essential federal support for education is a good thing.
Right. Well, in a lot of ways, you think about it and you say you can't solely exist just to stimulate jobs for certain people, high-paying jobs. In the end, you may be able to reorganize things, for example, letting the different states and the different communities take the money that would be coming from there and spend it the ways they think are necessary. And guess what? You probably would get more money this way as opposed to bureaucrats collecting some of it, or even some of this money evaporating to nothing. Who knows where it goes? There's probably even a strong argument that could be made that schools would be better off.
I think that's right. But let me just say that it is also the case that you have a lot of blue states which will, if you give the money in block grants to the Department of Education in Illinois or in California or in Massachusetts, you're going to have the same problem at the state level. The ideal thing is to give it to the parents and let them decide. That's not only because they'll make better decisions, but it's because there's almost nothing in our lives, your listeners will know this, there's just nothing that gets better if there's no competition, and there's no competition for public schools.
Let's just say hypothetically, okay? Hypothetically, mm-hmm. Each parent was given the allotment, X amount of dollars that is given to a public school, but the parent mm-hmm. can choose where their kids goes to school, and that money is applied to the school that they choose. So let's say hypothetically, in a perfect world, mm-hmm. that would kill public schools. What parent would pick a public school in their community if they had an opportunity for a private school? So what would that even look like if the money followed the kid around?
Well, you make a great point, and I would say a couple of things. The first thing is that if we're going to give parents money for their children's schooling, there will, of course, have to be some rules. You can't just spend it all on M&M candies, right? So, so there have to be some rules, and bureaucrats will have to set those. The second thing I would say is that parents have to be able to send their child free to a public school if that's what they choose, sort of pass up the money, but send their child to a public school. And what that will do is it will create an intense pressure on the schools to lower their own amounts of bureaucrats and to give parents what they want. Sometimes that's schooling. Sometimes it may be the hours that you can keep. If you and your wife are both working and working till 5 o'clock, you might want after school programs that are close by. You might prefer that even to a school that you thought was better. You might prefer a school that was close to your home. You might prefer a school that was close to where your other children were going to school. I can't say. That's the point about competition. That's why there are a lot of fast food restaurants. They compete with each other on price, on the food that they serve, on where they're located, all sorts of things.
You know, here's something I think is a thing I don't quite understand, is that mm-hmm. when you talk about how much money goes to each kid to a public school, it could be $12,000, $15,000, upwards to $20,000 follows that kid to the public school that they go to for the certain funding. But if you were to look at, let's say, a Catholic school or a private school, they're about $10,000. It's always less than the amount of money the federal government is giving to that public school. How is it possible that the better education comes to the student that is paying less, and by the way, out of their pocket, $10,000, than when the government gives a public school $20,000?
You have nailed two issues that I think are so important. One is that a lot of the money that we say is going to public schools is actually going to pay inflated pensions for retired school teachers. I'm in some sense a retired school teacher because I taught at the college level, but what we got was the same as a 401k. So we didn't get it. We don't get a pension. If I invested my money well, good. If I didn't, bad. But that's the way that all these things, what happens is at the state level, in a state like Illinois, what they do is they promise you a lot of things in the future, but then they don't actually have to pay for them now. And so that's a lot of the money. Second thing I want to say is about Catholic schools. Worst thing that's happened to Catholic education in modern history is too few nuns.
The reason with their rulers, yeah.
Really, the reason, yeah, I would pay for rulers for them. But the reason, one reason that Catholic schools were inexpensive and just such a great place for generations of working families in St. Louis and Chicago and Philadelphia and so on, is that they had a lot of teachers who were members of a religious order and were not seeking high pay. And so that all declined when the number of nuns declined. So it's a sad thing, but Catholic schools were great, and I say that as a non-Catholic.
You know, my father went to Catholic school in St. Louis, and he said those nuns were brutal. Boy, did he get in trouble, and his knuckles paid the price. But, you know, interesting I found about Catholic.
Did he bring home a ruler for you?
No, I mean, did it work? I think that's debatable. Okay, so when it comes to, like, Catholic schools, I found that the teachers, the principals, they mm-hmm. have that strong Catholic faith. However, the students, it seems like less than 50% are Catholic faith. They're only going there for the better education.
That's an interesting point. I haven't looked deeply into it, and it sounds like you certainly have. And all I would say is that my support for it wasn't about religious education per se. It was about the general schoolwork and the relatively low cost that was associated with that. But in any event, it's I think that they were that it's a shame that cities like St. Louis no longer have the Catholic school. They have Catholic schools, but they just don't have them in the numbers and at the cost that they used to be. Maybe you know more about it.
Well, I've just talked to different teachers to get a better understanding mm-hmm. of what was going on, and it's so funny. My doctor sends their kids to Catholic school. They're not Catholic. I said, why do you do that? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I feel like there is less violence at a Catholic school as opposed to other schools. So he looked at it as a safety issue.
Because they'll boot them out as soon as they do. But public schools are often not allowed to do that. But the point is not to boot them out. The point is to inculcate the right values in them.
Well, that's a big thing, and I think parents don't want to have to deal with all of these other issues that they hear about. My son goes to a public school, but it's one that you have to test into. You have to be a smarty pants, which I'm very proud of him for. But what I found is even in that case, we have to be so careful of the things that are being told to him because his classmates have older siblings. Older siblings introduce things to the younger siblings. Younger siblings introduce things to your kid. And you have to be so careful because you need to know the parents. You need to know the principal that they're not going to put up with that garbage inside of the public school. But it's a case-by-case basis, and not all of them abide or are able to monitor like a private school or a Catholic school that would just have no toleration for it.
You're raising another great point. I think it's much, much harder for parents to monitor their children today than it was when I was growing up and maybe when you were growing up because, they can just sort of disappear more easily into the world. But it's also the case that they can disappear online, and you just have no idea what they're looking at.
Wow. Well, you write for all kinds of different publications, but you also write about topics like this. If people wanted to look you up online, where can they go?
Charles Lipson, LIPSON, charleslipson.com, and I'm happy to send you, you can sign up there, and I'm happy to send you all of my columns for free. I must say, I love speaking with folks in St. Louis, and so I'm glad that you asked me on today.
Yep, and if there's a topic that you like that's going on here, just go to charleslipson.com and then you'll be able to message him that way. See all the other topics he's writing about. Thank you so much for joining us here. We really appreciate it.
Truly my pleasure.
Joining us after the break is our chief legal analyst, Brad Young. So many different things that are going on in the news right now when it comes to legality. I want to know, why is there certain topics that you can't talk about when it comes to Epstein, especially with Maxwell potentially getting out of prison and what happens in the future with that? They're telling her, oh, she can't talk about this. She can't talk about that. Why? What happened to her free speech? Why can't she talk about whatever she wants? Also, I want to know about the allegations regarding President Obama and Tulsi Gabbard's allegations against him. We're going to talk to Brad Young about that after the break. I'm Ryan Recker filling in. Don't go anywhere. 97.1 FM Talk. Always a pleasure when I get this opportunity to spend it with you and our chief legal analyst, partner at Hairstyle Fisher & Young, Brad Young. Hello, sir.
Ryan, good to talk to you, my friend.
That's 3 weeks in a row we get a chance to talk. Well, I think that's, 3 weeks in 4 interviews?
I think so. Good.
That might be a new record. I like it. All right. I wanted to look at some of the different allegations that Tulsi Gabbard made about the former president, Barack Obama. And legally speaking, when you go after a former president and some of the allegations that are made, I want you to give us an idea of the strength of the argument being made. And if you think this is something that has some legs that can move forward. So tell us, what do you think about the allegations first?
Well, the allegations would be difficult to prove. Essentially, the allegations are that the Obama administration knowingly instigated an investigation of then candidate or President-elect Trump in 2016, knowing that the information all came from the Steele dossier, which was paid for by the Clinton campaign, and that members of the intelligence community had already stated that the information was unreliable. And yet the Obama administration continued to make baseless assertions that there may be some sort of a Russian collusion, which we all know now is not only a hoax, but actually demonstrated that the Clinton campaign colluded with the Russians via the Steele dossier. So what can you do about it? Well, first of all, number one, as the Supreme Court has recently held, you cannot really go against a sitting president or a former president for official acts that the president did while in office. So based upon recent Supreme Court precedent, I don't see that there would be any action that could be taken against Barack Obama personally. Now, Secondly, could there be actions taken against members of the intelligence community that were part of the Obama administration in 2016? The answer is technically yes, because they wouldn't be covered under the same type of immunity that the Supreme Court gave the president. Having said that, the evidence would have to be so overwhelming. Mm-hmm. We haven't seen that yet. I don't know that you could make a criminal case in a court of law.
Okay. Let's say the whole crux of this is acting in your official capacity as president of the United States. If you are the leader of your party and you're acting to benefit your party, could you make the argument that you weren't acting as a president at that point?
Well, you could certainly make the argument, but the immunity given by the Supreme Court is extremely strong. And so it would really only have to be a plausible allegation that I was acting, concerned that even based upon the Steele dossier, that there was some type of Russian interference in the 2016 election. That in of itself would be more than enough to get past some sort of a summary judgment criminal case here. So I don't even think you could get an indictment on something like that. Mm. So really what this is focused on is the court of a public opinion, not a criminal court. But having said that, all of the major mainstream networks have been silent on this because obviously, if you don't talk about collusion, they're in collusion with the left in this country. So you're not seeing much in the court of public opinion because the mainstream media simply isn't covering it.
I'm going to ask this. This is going to be a frank question here. Let's say if it was roles reversed and it was Donald Trump being accused of this, they would have gone to the grand jury. They would have tried to get an indictment. They probably would have been successful to get an indictment. Do you disagree with that or agree?
No, not at all. But it would have to have been brought because it would have been brought in Washington, D.C. All right. And that's the thing that needs to be very clear here is mm-hmm. you want to talk about forum shopping. A lot of the left today was concerned about forum shopping. And yet if this were to be brought against Donald Trump, it would come in Washington, D.C., which is one of the most liberal cities in America. So it would have no problem getting a grand jury in Washington, D.C. to indict President Trump if he were in the exact same circumstances as President Obama. So, yeah, very easy to get an indictment in D.C. against Donald Trump.
Got it. Okay. So I guess we'll have to wait and see what the evidence is, whatever's released, to look at the severity of what it is. But based on the evidence that we've seen so far, doesn't sound like anything.
No. Well, I don't know that it doesn't sound like anything. It is concerning that you would literally have the president of the United States knowingly manufacture evidence and knowingly continue to investigate based upon evidence that he knew was simply a creation of a political campaign. That to me is very scary. Now, how much is that going to mean to the average Joe on the street? I'm not sure. But it is important information, and I'm certainly glad that it's getting out there.
Okay. Let's go to the Jeffrey Epstein stuff, because I'm curious about this, because I've seen different reports. For example, the assistant attorney general is going to interview Maxwell, and I always say her first name wrong. Ghislaine, is it? How you say it? I always
Ghislaine,
say it wrong.
Ghislaine. Ghislaine Maxwell.
I don't care how many times I've heard it and how many times other people have said it. I've always got it wrong. Ghislaine Maxwell. Some of the idea is, let's say part of her release would be she can't talk about anything. So where does the First Amendment kick in here? And what is she not allowed to talk about? How could they stop her from talking about anything she wants to talk about when it refers to Epstein?
Okay, let me see if I can break this down quickly and not turn it into a legal seminar. she's been convicted, right? But her case is still technically on appeal. So she doesn't want to talk very much about anything while there's still a slim chance that her convictions will be overturned. Now, the Court of Appeals has already rejected her appeal, and she's filed what's called a writ of certiorari with the Supreme Court, asking the Supremes to take it. The Supremes aren't going to take this case, but there's still the possibility that they could take it. So she doesn't want to go out and talk too much unless she gets a grant of immunity from Congress. And if Congress gives her a grant of immunity saying, we're not going to prosecute you for anything that you say to us, then at that point, she could be compelled to testify. Fifth Amendment doesn't apply if you've been giving a grant of immunity because you cannot be prosecuted for what you say. So that's the next step. And if anyone drags her in front of Congress to ask her questions in the absence of a grant of immunity, then that's just a political stunt to get her to say, I plead the fifth, I plead the fifth, I plead the fifth. Mm-hmm. All right. That is for political cinema and theater. It's not legitimate inquiry or questioning. So bottom line is, will she get a grant of immunity? Yes or no. If she does, it's a legitimate inquiry. If she does not, it's simply being done for the cameras.
Yeah. I think part of it is maybe they don't, she doesn't want people to find out how old she is in her obituary, because that seems to happen all that often. And you mentioned the writ of, writ would be a fantastic dog name, wouldn't it?
Writ, yeah, for certiorari. Actually, I desperately want to name my next dog Stay. So then when I get him trained and I say, come here, Stay, you know, he looks like he's a spaz. That's truly what I want to name my next dog.
Well, Stay's another legal term too, isn't it?
It is.
There's other ways you can work in that. It could be some confusion. There's so many
other Stirpes. You know, you could name a dog Per Stirpes, which is my favorite
constellation.
Term. No, Per Stirpes is actually a legal term talking about how wills, trusted estates are managed and distributed. But you know, if you name a dog Per Stirpes, the other dogs are just going to beat him up. Because
I know.
You got a stupid name, dog. We're going to beat you up.
Your little doggy pocket protector. And, yeah. Keep up with it. Are there any other legal things that you've been following? Something that is getting the legal community all worked up about?
Well, the one thing is, and I think this is what's interesting about the ongoing efforts to depose people who are here on student visas for things that they say. Okay. And we've seen this a lot in the news. In on university campuses where people come out, they say death to Israel from the river to the sea, and they make these kind of statements, and then they get deported, and people are screaming out saying, well, wait a minute, they got First Amendment rights. Yes, they do. But here's what's interesting. Nobody's talking about this, Ryan. You are breaking news right here, because as I dug into the Immigration and Nationality Act earlier this week, because I was bored. Okay, I looked into it, and and under the INI, you can actually, the State Department is empowered to deport any student and revoke their visa. And this is the phrase: activities that could have potentially serious adverse foreign policy consequences. Unquote. Now you hear that, and you think, well, yeah, but wouldn't the courts require that, you know, you can't deport somebody based upon violations of the First Amendment? Mm-hmm. Well, what's interesting about that is this has already been decided by the Supreme Court just last year. In the case of Buarfa versus Mayorkas, the Supreme Court issued a unanimous decision. Ketanji Brown Jackson actually wrote the opinion stating that if the State Department deports somebody, then their deportation is not subject to judicial review. So at this point, if people are going to get deported for things that they say, we may not like that from a First Amendment free speech type of perspective. But technically, if it happens, the courts can't overturn it, and it's probably going to be upheld as being valid.
Wow. Okay. That's a big one. Brad Young, Harris Dowell Fisher and Young, and some of the allegations from Tulsi Gabbard, also talking about the Ghislaine. I know I'm going to say it wrong again.
That's it. You got it. Ghislaine Maxwell.
Oh, Ghislaine Maxwell. No, all right. Ghislaine
Maxwell. Gollum. You know, like Gollum. Think of her as Gollum. All right. And then you can say Ghislaine.
I don't know. Brad, you're a smart guy. Are there any words you can't say properly? I cannot say that name. No,
I can't think of any words that I can't pronounce. I'm sure there are, but just none are coming to my mind.
Well, Brad Young, Chief Legal Analyst here on 97.1. Thank you for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure, Ryan, always.
So good at breaking these things down. He's the best, the best. All right, when we come back after break, I want to talk to Ethan, our producer, about a situation in my workplace and get his take on what I should do next, because I'm conflicted. Do I confront this coworker or do I not? And I think Ethan will give me the best advice coming up. I'm Ryan Recker filling in on 97.1 FM Talk. And welcome back. I'm Ryan Recker filling in. Thanks for joining us here. So I'm doing this whole setup remotely. I'm here in Detroit. Ethan, in that last segment with Brad Young, Could you hear me coughing? I potted it down, but it looked like the audio was still going through. Did you hear me cough on the show?
I didn't notice anything that was that loud or anything.
All right. Well, I potted it down, but I got this little VU meter, and it made it look like it may still be sending audio. And I thought, oh, no, did everyone hear me cough? Well, Brad Young was explaining something, so I'm glad that didn't happen. Right, you are, I would say, a stickler for etiquette. Would that be an accurate description?
A stickler for etiquette.
I don't know if that's true or not.
I don't know. I mean, stickler's a strong word, and etiquette can mean a lot of things. So I would say, you know, I take good care of myself, and I'm semi-disciplined, but I don't know if I'd say stickler necessarily.
Okay, well, I'm going to give you a couple of scenarios, and I want you to tell me what you think is worse. And this is workplace etiquette. Leaving crumbs at a shared workplace or eating a smelly lunch next to someone.
Say the first one again.
Leaving crumbs at a workplace after you leave.
Ooh, good question. It depends on the simple answer, I think, is the second one. No one likes a smelly lunch.
Okay. You know, I'm the guy that eats a smelly lunch, though.
But but here's the thing. Where it gets worse is depending on what the crumbs are and how messy it is. If it's a couple of breadcrumbs from a sandwich, I'm not concerned about it. But like if it gets to the point where it's like, okay, this is ridiculous, then I'm not about it. So it's hard to give a straight up answer on that one.
Right. Okay, so I'm working my way up to what I witnessed here. You can tell me what I should do next. Okay, the next one is, let's say, smelly lunch, what's worse, or microwaving fish at work?
Microwaving fish at work or smelly crumbs?
Smelly lunch next to someone.
Right. Well, I mean, they're super similar, are they not? Like, I mean,
okay,
right?
Smell.
I mean, they're both based around smell and food that you're eating. I don't remember the last time that anyone here at work has microwaved fish, so I can't. I'm trying to like recall like what fish smells like when you microwave
it. Terrible. Oh, it's
that
gross.
Bad.
Oh, okay, let's just escalate this to the next one.
Yeah, sure. Okay.
What's worse, microwaving fish at work or not washing your hands in the bathroom?
Oh, it has to be the not washing your hands in the bathroom, right?
It's pretty gross, isn't it?
That's bad.
Okay, I caught my coworker red-handed not washing their hands at the bathroom.
Oh, God.
And it's someone that everyone loves. Everyone loves this guy. So here's what happened. And this is, there's been instances in the past where I've suspected someone wasn't doing that. Like you'd be in the restroom and next thing you know, you're like, oh, that's weird. I didn't hear the water run and the person's not here anymore. Like, oh, I know what happened, but you never knew who it was. I was using the restroom. Okay. Go and I wash my hands, do my thing. And as I'm opening the door to leave, it squeaks. You know, the door squeaks. I hear the flush behind me. Okay, that's fine.
Okay.
So I leave. I counted them, 9 steps. I reenacted this to see how far away I was to try to time this like a CSI. I was 9 steps out and I hear the door creak again. And I thought, there is no way someone could have washed their hands, dried their hands, and left in the time it takes me to do 9 steps, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9 steps. And I turn around to see who left without washing their hands. And it was the coworker everyone loves. And I think he knew I caught him in the act because I turned around to look who it was and I saw him. We made eye contact.
Oh, so this is not a question of like, there's no way that he could spin this and say, no, I didn't do this. You missaw. This is a for sure, like you caught him in the act.
I think I caught him because he was very chatty after that. Like, oh, I need to, you know, a little nervous chatty. You know what I mean?
Oh, I know what you mean.
Yeah. It's like when you're caught doing something, you're like, okay, let me see if I could divert whatever they're thinking about to something else. I better start inserting different thoughts into their mind right away. So now I know, and most likely they know too. I know they've been doing this for a while. I just haven't caught the person. Now I have. Do I confront this person? What do I do?
This is a sticky situation. I have a couple of questions for you about this person. If you were to confront them, first off, this is not a boss, right? This is someone that is either equal on your level, right, or below, or is this a boss?
No, this is someone that's equal, I guess. Okay. Not a boss.
All right. Okay. So that's good. Now, if you are you concerned about friendship on the line here potentially?
Ooh, it would make me sad if things got weird. Like, you know, like, because you kind of enjoy talking to the, everyone likes this person.
Now, here's the question that you have to ask yourself, Ryan Recker.
Yeah.
You have to ask yourself, Are you willing to put this relationship, whether it be a friendship, whether it be just acquaintanceship, are you willing to put that on the line potentially to have this conversation that could be for the greater good? It could be.
His hands, he's touching shared computers.
Oh,
I mean, and think of it. There's other things he's like, we're talking to shared equipment in the studio, things that everyone uses, everyone touches. And all I can think of is if he's come in contact with it, I know where those hands have been. And now I'm thinking to myself, what do I do? Do I have to say something for the good of everyone?
Listen, I think that you have to. I think that you have with the further details that you have shared, I feel like you are in a place of necessity, in a place where, you know, there's a little bit of risk, but where the potential reward outweighs the risk. Because even if you lose a friendship here, I mean, you're taking one for the team and getting a win for the office here. And it's going to be a win for him too, because you're going to him first. You're not telling other people. You know,
I have a plan now. Okay. Tell me, here's my plan. I'm going to wait until I see him, you know, go to the restroom. Of course, you don't announce it or anything. It just happens. But I'm going to have to pay close attention.
Mm-hmm.
Here's my plan. Maybe about 30 seconds after he leaves, I get up. I go to the restroom as well. OK. And I just stand by the sink like I'm messy with my collar, looking at my eyebrows or whatever. And as soon as I see him come out, I stare him down to make sure he washes his hands like I'm looking at him. And while he's washing them, I'll say something like, oh, it's so good to wash your hands, isn't it? Or just to reinforce, like, you know, I know you better start doing it. This is the subtle way. You think that's a good plan?
So you're thinking of maybe doing this in steps to where you don't have to just straight up call him out.
Yeah, exactly.
I think that's a good idea because that's you're risking the area of no point of return if you get to that point. That's a weird conversation to have.
Like, what if he blows it off altogether? Like, yeah, I'm just there, and I'm like, wait, and he just goes and doesn't even think twice.
Then you
he's gone. Then you have to.
Then I think that you have to. Yeah, right. I think you have to.
Sue, this is weird guy bathroom talk. Of course, no girls would ever use the restroom without washing their hands. This is even a problem with women.
That's why I left and came back.
Because you don't even have to worry about it.
That is correct.
Guys are gross. That's the moral of the story.
I'm not sure it's any of your business. I just wouldn't shake his hand.
Oh man. But if touching shared computers is something he shared when you weren't in here, if it's affecting him, it's affecting coworkers.
Yes,
it's pretty nasty.
Everyone.
All right.
Now, I don't think he's, you know, cutting cake or anything that everyone's using, but okay. Well, I'll think about this, and I'll have to let you know how this one goes. Coming up after the break, of course, Sue's News. We're going to do that after when we get into the next hour. I'm really looking forward to that. I'm Ryan Recker, filling in for Mark Reardon, 97.1 FM Talk.
Get more at 97.1talk.com.